I brought a plan in advance. My teachings don't trust me, at least the basic. And but I have to give Ginger something to put in the bulletin at least by Thursday. So I did that this week, but I woke up Saturday morning. I'd been dreaming some Friday night. I realized that I was thinking a lot about our country. So, this is what I had planned today, but I did think about it a little bit yesterday and this morning, and I would like to share these with you. This is a reflection. Oh, yes,
ma'am.
You may. And what I'm going to reflect on is simply some thoughts today, and probably some thoughts that you've heard before from me. And I apologize ahead of time that few of these references are more personal, because a lot of times what we feel about our country is based upon personal experiences that we have had, for good or for bad, about what goes on in our country. And I'm going to start by saying we love this country, for sure. And yet we have to be honest about the fact that our record is not always beautiful. I have talked over and over about the Native Americans, or what we would call American Indians, who used to live right along here. And they had names, funny names, that you and I have a hard time pronouncing. And we don't know a single one of those names now. And one of the reasons is that we participated in genocide. Yes. Our forefathers participated in genocide. We didn't own this land when we came across the Atlantic Ocean. If anything, they did. But they were a wandering group of people, and they didn't have borders and fences and things like that. So it was hard to nail down, although they did have their sense of what was their territory. And we bought it. And we need to own up to that, and we do own up to that, and realize that. And there's a sort of thing, a mark against our enemies that will go down forever and ever, because we have never been able to rectify or do anything particular about it. Then when we move up in history, the next thing is not so good either. Slavery. We were probably the last country in civilized Western Hemisphere to participate in slavery. England had gotten rid of it, most of France and other countries had gotten rid of it. But we didn't, and we held on to it, and it led finally to the most bloody battle that the United States has ever participated in, and that's the Civil War. But slavery lingers on. I'm thinking of Selma, Alabama. Can you remember seeing on television those dogs that the military had out there holding the black people back, barking at them, biting them? Not a pretty picture. I'm thinking of Emmett Till, a perky little guy from Chicago, a teenage boy, who perhaps was ill-advised, and what he did was not good. He sort of whistled at a white woman in the grocery store. And for that, her husband and her compliance with him took him out and hung him and then drowned him and pulled him through the water to an unsightly grave. Close to home, when I was dean of the cathedral in the 60s, downtown here, the mayor at that time built a tank. And we would all like to get it. It was called Thompson's Tank after the mayor. He took a truck and he then attached steel plates all around it. And he mounted a 50-caliber machine gun on top. And then he had a big floodlight in front of it. And when there was restlessness at Jackson State, I remember the dean called me, the dean of students out there, called me at the cathedral and said, for God's sake, John, get some white people out here and get them in the windows of the Jackson State dormitory. They're going to shoot. And what the mayor did is atrocious. He put Charles Evers, Medgar Evers' brother, Medgar Evers had been killed by a sniper. He put Charles Evers in front of that tank, put the spotlight on him, and he had a police officer mounted behind the machine. And they moved through the streets after Jackson State, and Charles Evers was given a bullhorn and instructed to tell the students that to go back, get out of the streets, and go back into the dormitory, to try to keep them from violence. To keep them from violence was a very noble thing, but the method of doing so was not so noble. I remember a year or two later, I invited Charles Evers to come out to St. Andrew's Day School there in St. Old Canton Road. And I invited a bunch of the business leaders in Jackson to come there. They came. And Charles Evers had gotten a little bolder now. He'd been mayor of, I think, Fayette or something like that. And he sat in and sat on the edge of a table in the library of the dining room. And he looked around at these white leaders and he had the guts to say, y'all look awfully afraid. I thought that was wonderful for him to make that comment. And then we can leave that, but we're still not done with it. We're still not done with it. And we have got to, and it probably will take another generation or two with people who will say, the civil rights movement, what was that? But we live with it, and we bear the scars, and we bear the guilt. Not that the African-American people are all totally righteous in what they do, and there is not. They're not. But that's no excuse for anything that we do. I've asked myself, do I have any racism in my heart? And as much as I would like to say, no, I don't, I have to say, in a way, it's in me. It's part of my blood. It's part of my race. And I can't just will it to get away. I want it to get away. And so we still labor with that. Then we come on up into the 20th century, in a way, and contemplate on the horror of the war. And as you all know, I was a lead navigator in the 8th Air Force. Out of England, and bombed all over Germany, killing, I'm sure, a lot of people. After the war in 1947, I was at the University of Chicago, and I lived in what was called the International House. It had students from all over the world. My roommate was a young man from Sweden, who did not participate in the Second World War. But when I went up to my room one evening, he had two guests, two young men. I was probably at this time 21 or 2 years old. And so I was introduced to them. And they said they were from Germany. Well, that tensed me up just a little bit. And they said, "Were you in the military?" I said, "Yes." They said, "So were we. We were on the Russian front." "Where were you?" I said, "In England." "In the Air Force?" "Yes." "You bombed Germany?" I said, "Yes, I did." "Did you ever bomb Frankfurt?" I said, "Many times." They said, "Our parents were killed in those raids." I put out my hand to them. They didn't offer theirs, so I withdrew mine. And all I could say was, "I'm sorry." And I walked out into the darkness of the night and pondered the horrors of war. But I concluded that what we did had to be done. And yes, if the circumstances were the same, I would do it again, as much as I would deplore the horrors of war. Now, there is a strange thing about pondering our faults. And the Christian religion knows this very well. That sometimes when we acknowledge our faults, we grow stronger. If we own up to what we have done and not deny it, there's a way in which what we have done wrong begins to teach us. And we may be able to improve. It makes us more sensitive, and we are more sensitive to the tragedies of war, more sensitive to racial discrimination, more sensitive to the way we treat Native Americans. I have to own up to the fact, as you all well know, I did not have a very perfect life or a very moral life. And I feel great part of the failure of my first marriage. And yet I am a better priest because of those tragedies. Way in which our failures can make us strong. And I call upon you as Americans not to simply gloat over the good things about our country, but to face honestly what we have done wrong and learn from that and grow stronger so that we may be even a better path in the future. There's something about the heart of America that I think is lost. We separate church and state, and that's as we should, but a great deal of the character of the American people is founded by drawing lessons from the person of Jesus and his way of life. We don't insist that people become Christians. But there's something powerful about that. I have here a picture that I may show you before. If y'all keep getting new, don't have records, and keep getting me to come be the interim, you can get the same study. Dennis, this is a picture of a man in your profession. He was a medic. He was lined up with the troops that were firing, simply no more than across this church at the other people in the Iraq War. Out in the middle, right there, in the middle, was this little child, probably 3 or 4 years old. The child was screaming because everything was bursting all around him. He couldn't stand it, and he ran out in the middle. He had a rifle around his shoulder. He has a helmet on. He scoops up this little child and turns and runs back behind our line and saves the child's life. I'm not saying that other countries don't have people that would do that. But I am mighty damn glad that we have some who will. There's something also about the character of the American people that when crises happen around the world, and we don't want to take pride in this, but it's true. We respond to things no matter whether they were our former enemies or not. But we respond with more giving and more reaching out to people in distress than any other nation in the world. And I'm glad we do. And when we think about the war, you know, it's interesting, I can't find, and I'm a history student, I can't think of anybody else that ended a major war as we ended the Second World War and did what we did. Instead of leaving the Germans and the Japanese to simply waller and blow up buildings, the Marshall Plan, right away implemented in 1946, rebuilt Germany and Japan and made them strong nations once again. We gave it to them. They weren't asked to repay it. We brought it to them. I like that. Our democracy here in the United States is not perfect by any means. Our leaders tend to abuse the power in seeking power rather than the good of the nation. But sometimes we need people to rise up and call that abuse what it is. It's no mistake we're in some difficulty in our national government right now. We are not governing ourselves as we should be. And we need to be open and vocal. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, that's not the point here. The point is we are not governing ourselves in a noble-like way. And therefore we need to call the abuse what it is, and we need to step forward and try to do better and encourage our leaders to do better. And I just would like to close with this. Looking back over my life, I think World War II was far more critical in the formation of me than I ever thought about until maybe 10 years ago. I recall one day taking our bomb group, which would be 60, 17, over to Czechoslovakia, which is as far as the B-17 could go and get back home. And when we got over there, the clouds began to build up. And you can't fly from 17 past 30,000 feet. You just can't steer it. And so we went in and out of clouds and dispersed our planes to separate so we wouldn't run into each other. When we came out of one cloud and there we could see something, there was a plane in front of us, not much further than our parasol. I could identify that as a German plane, and we opened fire with about 5 machine guns. And all of a sudden, big billowing smoke came out for that plane in front of us. And we saw a big flash of fire. And it turned and banged and started down. And when it turned, and we could see the silhouette, we had shot down a B-17. And then we saw the parachute out, knowing that as far away as Czechoslovakia and German territory, they would never get back. We didn't talk much coming back to England. And as in every case on a mission, you would go, the officers would go in for debriefing. And they would always have a jigger of bourbon for you, which we needed to get to. And we didn't plan this, but the 4 of us as officers on our lead plane, we told the debriefing officer that we had shot down a B-17 from some other group. He took the bourbon and poured another glass for each other. He said, take this and sleep well. That's common sense. It's nothing to brag about. But nevertheless, it shows, is that debriefing officer ability to understand we didn't intend that. There's no need to carry it further. And he never mentioned it again. And I think from time to time of the land crews. The land crews would be 5 or 6 people assigned to each B-17. And their job, they didn't fly. Their job was to make it run. Right. And on days when we would come back and the clouds would be overcast and you couldn't find the runway because we didn't have this modern equipment, they would go down there and build a huge bonfire at the beginning of the runway. And we could come over close enough to where that base was and see that through the clouds, we could see that plane of burning fires and rubble and stuff, and circle around and aim through the fire and hit the runway. And I recall on one occasion, the land crew was sitting there still at the beginning of the runway, and light fell, and they were still there. And they were waiting for that 17 that would never return. We have many faults in our country, but I'm proud to be an American. I would like you to stand and sing one verse of hymn 220. It's the last hymn in the nation. Wait, before you start that, I want to tell you one other story. A few years back, they raised enough money to refurbish the Statue of Liberty, and they built a huge scaffolding up to the top. And when it was done, somebody, it wasn't planned, caught a picture of the last man to come down from my statue. And they caught a picture of him as he was passing by the face of Our Lady in that statue. And he leaned over and kissed her on the cheek. What a wonderful thing to do. And I'm sure whether he knew it or not, he had in mind these words engraved at the foot of that statue. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Let's sing.